O'Malley. The location of the interview is in Pittsburgh at Reverend O'Malley's residence in Highland Park, and we're speaking Saturday evening on April 6, 2002. And the purpose of this interview is to document the history of the United Farm Workers Great Boycott, and we are interviewing people who were very involved in the boycott, and one reason Father O'Malley is being interviewed is because he was one of the active supporters of the boycott during the late 60s and early 70s. And to just mention the relationship of the narrator to the interviewer, I do know Father O'Malley, and I've known him probably for more than 30 years, consider him my friend, so there is a personal acquaintance happening before this interview. And I'd like to begin by asking Father O'Malley's oral consent to taping of this interview, and I'm going to ask you if it's okay,
yes,
Father Jack?
Okay. Very much so.
Thank you. And I'm going to begin by asking you to talk a little bit about yourself, to just give a personal background about some of the activities you've been in and some of the interests that led you in the beginning to being involved in the Great Boycott, so that those who would be listening to your record later would have some idea about your background.
I'm 65 years of age, a lifelong resident of Pittsburgh, one of seven children, born and raised in the city of Pittsburgh. Went to parochial schools, and in 1959 graduated from college with a degree in economics. Intending to go to law school, made a decision at that summer to attend the seminary at St. Vincent's in Latrobe. Was ordained in 1965, and the 60s happened to be a busy time in our world and in our lives. Between the Vietnam War, between the Civil Rights Movement, and locally in the late 60s, early 70s, Cesar Chavez sending people like the Rojas family to the parish that I worked in on the north side of Pittsburgh, and it involved me very deeply and taught me much about the food that I eat and the reason that we as church people should be involved. And so those 60s helped me stay involved to learn about many of the other movements in these last 37 years as a priest in the Diocese of Pittsburgh.
Oh, thank you. And I was wondering, Reverend Jack, around 67 to 70, you were probably in your 30s in terms of how old you were during the boycott, going back maybe about that time.
I was probably 30, 31, 32 at that time, yeah.
Okay. Thank you. And considering you had a major role in the boycott, I was just wondering, I have been asking people whether they saw their role as actively picketing, making telephone calls, and speaking to groups. For yourself, would you describe yourself as pretty much having all those roles plus some more?
Well, when we were asked, and I don't know exactly how it happened, to house some of the farm workers, we did that. And we did that because we felt that was the right thing to do. And when we heard that the budget that they were on, we knew that they needed economic and moral support. And in so many of these cases that you get involved in, you realize that the people coming living with you and sharing their story do more for you than you have done for them. So it was a wonderful education for us. It was a challenge, especially when we were asked to get up at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning to go to the downtown Pittsburgh where the fruits and vegetables were delivered. That was one of the most difficult times, but I was always grateful for Cesar Chavez and the farm workers for giving me a graduate degree in social justice and Catholic teaching.
No, thanks. That's a very interesting, take on it, and a good way of putting it, I think, for, somebody like yourself who was involved in it. And I have been asking people how they saw themselves and what affiliation they were with in terms of student groups or religious congregations or union members. And clearly, as a Catholic priest, you would consider yourself probably an activist plus also as a member of a religious congregation. And I assume that's correct, that would be how you would identify yourself, your involvement.
Well, I think Cesar Chavez challenged and encouraged the Catholic Church, him being a Catholic, and most of the farm workers were Catholic Christian people. And I think Cesar challenged the bishops to act upon their faith and to see that there was dignity in the workplace, in the fields. And after we were educated, and after we were challenged to put the scriptures and our Catholic teaching into practice, we were the better for it. So yeah, I would see myself as a pastor working with parishioners because they lived in our area. They lived actually in the rectory and in a building next door to the rectory, the former convent. I'd see myself as a person that was encouraged and challenged because of my faith. And then, of course, with the families that stayed with us, the relationships. And when you build this relationship of trust and confidence, and you visit California and you see the conditions, hear the stories of the plight of migrant farm children in going from school to school, you can see how disrupted their lives were and the education. And so your hearts went out to them, but at the same time, they were our mentors at the time. And I basically followed some real good directions and leadership.
Oh, thank you. And when Rojas came, you said you've been a lifelong resident of Pittsburgh. Had you met Mexican-American families before this time yourself at any time, or was this really the first experience you had with people?
That was probably the first in-depth experience. Maybe there were casual meetings before, but nothing that I can think of.
Okay, thank you. And in terms of when the family came, Albert and Elena came with their three children, and then they had another child while they were here. Thinking back, and this is sort of looking backwards, what did you feel at that time was Albert's role, and what did you think was Elena's role in terms of how that family could fit into the workings of the boycott?
Well, they were both articulate. They were both very committed to their families, to their church, and to the movement. And their role was to educate us, to put us out there with them, and to see that we used all the contacts and influences we had in the city to work with other people who were also involved at that time in the civil rights movement and peace movements. And I think the Merton Center, the Peace and Justice, Thomas Merton Peace and Justice Center was getting underway at the time. And to bring a group of clergy and laity who would be probably considered progressive Catholics who were prepared to act on their faith. This was also Vatican Council II time, and this was really the age of the laity. And so, you know, the laity were teaching the clergy in many ways, the Rojases and farm worker families and other Catholic lay people and Christian lay people and Jewish folks were teaching us. So we might have had some of the scripture, but they had the lived experience.
Yeah.
And it was a wonderful marriage, wonderful relationship.
Well, thanks. That's good insights, because I was going to talk about the religious aspects, and this is really great that you've covered some of this already. In terms of other people, just thinking about other people who worked with the boycott during that time, were there members of the community whom you met that you might not have known before this time, that when we got involved in the actual picketing and talking to people, were there folks that were really, it was the first time you had met them in the Great Boycott?
I'm thinking of a fellow by the name of Jim McCoy, who was a black man and who was a leader of the NAACP at that time. Mm-hmm. He got very involved in it, and perhaps I did meet him in the civil rights struggle also, but I think I got to know him better in the Great Boycott, along with other leaders from the African-American community. I think there were a lot of lay and religious folk that I probably wouldn't have come into contact with if it wasn't for the Rojas family and the Great Boycott. Mm-hmm. So it was about building relationship, and it was about the continuation of acting on your faith, the Vatican II, and about another civil rights struggle. And so it all came together. And so there were many, many people, Dr. Horowitz and a Jewish doctor from McKees Rocks and his family, and all sorts of people, that Al Rojas had this wonderful, and Elena had this wonderful way of teaching and bonding and building relationships. And people would come over to St. Joseph's Church who maybe I would have never met if it hadn't been for the Rojas family.
Right. So, okay, thank you. Did, in any of the groups, did, and I'll mention students and labor union members and maybe some other political activists, did your opinions of any of the groups change over time, either positively or negatively? Were the groups that you might have had a better understanding with after that time that it made a difference? Okay, we were just talking about the opinion of some of the groups. Would you say that there were any changes that you felt at that time? Perhaps not, that, you know, there were opinions you might have held before that after the boycott, they might have changed a little bit?
Well, certainly the United Steelworkers, as a union, was very financially supportive of Rojas family and the farm workers after the Rojas family. So, I mean, that was a real good introduction to me to the unions. I'm now a union labor chaplain. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how much influence that had on me, but it certainly exerted a positive influence on me because I can remember going to the steelworkers' office regularly with Albert and Elena and the children. And I knew that they supported them in many, many different ways, connecting them and introducing them to other unions. And financially helping the family out. That, by the way, as I recall, the family's budget was $5 a week at that time.
That's right. That's true. And I think that was something that lasted throughout the boycott. They were very strict about keeping that very minimum kind of voluntary poverty, I think, standard. And in terms of working on the boycott for that period of time, since you have lived in Pittsburgh and you're still here, would you say you're still acquainted with people you work with during that time and perhaps still have contacts with them and work with them on other issues that those relationships sort of lasted over time?
Well, our Association of Pittsburgh Priests that was instituted around that same time, in fact, was instituted around 65, a year or so after I was ordained. I'm still working with many, many of the people with the Association of Pittsburgh Priests, priests and laity who belong now to our Association of Pittsburgh Priests, and many of the people from the Thomas Merton Peace and Justice Center. A lot of faces have changed, but a lot of faces are the same. So they're still intact, and the institution of intact of the Association of Pittsburgh Priests and the Thomas Merton Center, so, and Pax Christi, perhaps. But organizations like that and the NAACP, those organizations are still in place, and our relationships are deeper, and the issues might be a little bit different, but farm workers are still in our hearts because, and for many people, that was the first real, real deep involvement in Catholic social teaching and in justice.
Well, that's thanks for bringing that out, because that's a very important point, that this would have been the first chance they really had to actively work on this and sort of feel that they were doing something that their faith community called them to do. And and I have another question about the community and the boycott. After the Great Boycott, a second family, the Valencias, and some probably five or six other volunteers came with them from California as organizers for the next boycott, the lettuce boycott, which was separate but the same in that it was the farm workers. And I'm wondering if you continued, do you remember if you continued your involvement with the lettuce boycott, or did was it pretty much that you stopped after the Great Boycott, or did you continue the involvement later?
The Great Boycott was just the beginning of involvement with farm workers. Family after family came, and most of them stayed with us or in our neighborhood on the north side of Pittsburgh. Mm-hmm. And they continue to educate and inspire us and encourage us and challenge us to continue to act on our faith. So the Great Boycott was just the beginning of our relationship with many migrant farm workers, and also it encouraged me to make different visits to California. So the educational process continues, and the challenge to live by our faith continues.
Yeah, so you actually had the opportunity to not only work with them here, but you actually did go to California and sort of see the conditions firsthand. You had that opportunity.
We were very fortunate to meet Caesar and to visit the headquarters of the farm workers, mm-hmm. and to be in the fields with some of the farm workers, and to meet people like Father Eugene Boyle and many of the people some affiliated with church, some not, but working in California at a closer proximity to the farm workers. But we had wonderful relationships. It was we certainly gained more than the farm workers did.
Okay, thank you for pointing that out. During the boycott, I was going to talk a little bit about the different communities involved and sort of have your reflections on them. During the boycott, there were frequent leafletings and money collections that were taken at the plant gates and mostly steel mills when the steel industry was still operating in Pittsburgh. And these were the ones that were held generally before dawn. And I'm wondering if you remember if you went on any of those collections?
I went on many of the collections, as we did on some of the picket lines at the produce yards. Mm-hmm. And they were some of the most difficult times, but also some of the most rewarding times, because we saw the generosity of unions sticking together and helping this this small union, which is now quite large, get on its way. So many of the steel workers and the other people at the plant gates did not forget where they came from, that they had small beginnings also. As I said earlier, the steel workers, I think, were in the lead on this. But that was a one of those times that your telephone would ring or your alarm would go off at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning, and you used to ask yourself, why did I get involved? Why did I say yes? Why are the Rojases still here? Will the Valencias ever go home? Those little questions that you ask yourself, but in the final analysis at the day's end, you realize that, once again, they help you to live your faith, and we were always grateful.
Oh, thanks. And we mentioned the steel workers. There were a couple of unions that were also helping out. I'm just wondering if you remember offhand, and this is obviously going back quite a bit, to any of the either people or some of the other unions that you remember offhand in Pittsburgh that were helping out in the boycott along with the steel workers?
Well, I mean, a lot of the unions were involved, because Albert was very good at pushing the right buttons, and so he was deeply involved with the Allegheny Labor Council.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And the Labor Council is the umbrella for many, many unions, crafts, buildings and trades people, electrical workers, transit people. And so Albert had the ear of the head of the Labor Council, and he would speak regularly at the Labor Council meetings. Now, now being a labor chaplain, I attend that monthly meeting, and I can see the forum that he spoke at. In fact, I went with him at several different meetings. And so Albert pushed all the right buttons, and he really laid the challenge out there. He was a missionary, and he taught us well.
Yeah, thanks. That's a good description of somebody who's in this work, and actually probably, I guess, using sort of a religious term to talk about what he did in the community. And moving on to the religious community, which obviously you're going to have feel a part of, I have asked people whether they had a religious affiliation at the time of the boycott, and you have already said that you were, you know, a Catholic priest and a pastor at that time. And at that point, do you remember that the Catholic community had, you would consider them had a position or were fairly active in the boycott? Do you remember that you would say that they were, as a group, a little active in this?
I think the Catholic Church, one of the proudest moments was the boycott, the farm workers' grape and lettuce boycotts, for a couple reasons. And I think the leadership of the church, through the influence of Cesar Chavez and other farm workers nationally, got the ears of the leadership of the church, mm-hmm. cardinals and bishops. And I think because of Cesar's church affiliation and his faith, because he wore his faith on his sleeve, he influenced the bishops, who then would give access to the Catholic churches. And then once the farm workers got out into the different parishes and areas, then their leadership took over. And I think lots of lay people, and especially their sisters, the religious communities, mm-hmm. and lots of priests, got deeply involved, whether it was a homily and a sermon, whether it was taking another look at the Catholic social teaching, whether it was inserts in the bulletin, whether it was having the farm worker family speak at church, have a dinner for them, have fundraisers. and just allow the farm workers to preach their message, which is a compelling message. Whenever you sit down at the table to eat, and you begin to realize that the farm workers don't have enough money to eat like we were eating, it certainly really made you halt before you said your prayers before your meals, to think of the pesticide in the fields, the growers who would not allow farm workers to organize, and then the wonderful history and labor tradition that we have here in Pittsburgh. The connection was easy to make, and the farm workers did it well. The Catholic Church, I think it was a very proud moment for them, as well as other Christian churches and many Jewish, many people of the Jewish community.
Right. Wow. Okay. Thank you. And so you're in an ideal position to answer my next question, and that is, as you now serve presently in 2002, when we're speaking, as a labor chaplain for in Pennsylvania, do you think that the religious groups would support activities today, or are they supporting them today in the same sense that they did before, or do you have a sense that it might have shifted, that they wouldn't, or that they do? And you, as I said, would be the ideal person to answer this question, since they're dealing really with the same community over a period of time.
Well, you know, I think the unions were much stronger in the 60s, and so they had the wherewithal to help a union that was just beginning. So that was to the advantage. And I think economic times were better for people in many ways than they are now.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that helped the farm workers, because many people were working then and would hear the plight of the farm workers and would chip in many, many different ways. And then once again, it was the time that I always consider the time of wonderful education and inspiration. You had the Vatican Council II that really challenged us as clergy people to get involved, and lay people, the age of the lady for lay people to act on their faith. You had the Vietnam War going, and you had a wonderful peace movement. Mm-hmm. And then you had Dr. King and the Civil Rights Movement. Then you have a person like Cesar Chavez. And then you start looking internationally with Gandhi and people. So we had a real rich resource of people and wonderful leadership. And so, could they pull it off again today? I mean, Cesar Chavez was a charismatic leader. But I mean, we also learned over those years, you just can't depend on one person, because if you get rid of the leader, mm-hmm. Then the whole movement could be hurt. But there's no doubt about it, Cesar was a key figure, and he was very instrumental. I mean, he was so influential that when he visited the Philippines, I mean, he visited the Philippines, and Marcos took him on a tour. To a lot of progressive people, this hurt the movement, because a lot of people were against Marcos in the Philippines. But Cesar did it for the right reason, for his Filipino workers and migrants. But a lot of people kind of took a little walk from the movement. So that's how influential Cesar was, that if he would do something, you know, in the plus side, he'd get more, you know, mm-hmm. support. But there's no doubt about it, he was key, and he knew how to push the right buttons, and he had to keep people nationally and locally. He sent out wonderful, beautiful people, and they built relationships, and that's what trust was about, and that's how you build a movement,
yeah.
Getting to know people.
So thank you, because you're bringing out the point that it was really that all those circumstances in that period of time were really important in terms of how it worked, just because there were really good things going on all at the
same time.
Well,
the campuses were alive. Young people were much more involved. Now, we see a resurgence of that now, which really gives us hope.
Right.
Campuses are coming alive. But at that time, it was all coming together, because people were coming together for a lot of reasons, whether it was about the war, and whether it was about the environment, whether it was about struggling rights for people who work, and civil rights, of course, and women's rights. So it was all coming together. It was a wonderful time to be alive, and a wonderful time to learn and be involved.
Okay, thank you. And I was just going to mention two conflicts, which happened during the time of the boycott, and I'll just talk about whether you remember them and if you had a role in them. And one was, as you mentioned, there were some major civil rights initiatives at that time, and one of them that began in Pittsburgh was the Black Construction Coalition, which was a movement that attempted to integrate the unionized building trades, and of course these building trades were supporting the farm workers as members of the, you know, Allegheny County Labor Council. And during that campaign, there were thousands of people who demonstrated in Pittsburgh and hundreds of people arrested. And I am going to ask you if you do remember this. I'm sure you did. And were you also personally involved in that campaign yourself?
I was involved personally at the campaign. I remember it. I don't remember all the details, but I remember us marching around the U.S. Steel Building during that time. And I remember days when there were a lot of arrests. And there was a lot of tension, racial tension at the time, as there was nationally, but that brought it home to us, trying to integrate some of the trades, you know. So I remember that well. I mean, and I think that was all part of the civil rights struggle, and farm worker people were involved also.
That's what I was going to say, in the farm worker involvement. In some of the demonstrations, people who obviously supported the Black Construction Coalition also went as members of the Boycott Support Committee, so they would be carrying the WALGA flags and those during the march. And do you remember that that was a slight point of contention, because the unions who were supporting the farm workers were obviously seeing farm workers taking a position that they might not have been comfortable with at the time? And do you remember that as being a little bit of a conflict, or was that not a major issue for you, that there might have been some attention brought to Albert and to the boycott community that... you know, they felt it was a little heavy for the people to be carrying signs, you know, who they consider were their supporters, even though this was not a major issue. Do you remember that?
Well, I think that would probably be one of the issues that we would talk about, that when problems become close at home and locally, they become more difficult. There's more gray area. Whereas we from the East Coast will look at Delano and the boycott, and we would see it real clear. There were growers and there were workers, and we were going to stay with the workers.
Right.
Whenever you come in and there's a union that's trying to work for economic justice, and someone's challenging them to integrate, and they feel they have their autonomy to do what they do, because they would say, like, you know, some of the trades are so tight that was only family members getting in. But and then when you see brown-skinned people like the Rojas family and black people and white people come together, then that Rainbow Coalition was coming together. So I think that that it was real clear there would be tension with the unions. And the real tension came whenever the Teamsters started to try to get some contracts from the farm workers.
Right. Mm-hmm.
So there you had the ultimate union tension,
right,
when Teamsters started to try to represent farm workers. And that was a real tension for a lot of people in the Labor Council and the religious community and so forth.
Because that's true, right.
So there was all kind of tension in that.
And that had happened before, and I think my memory serves me right, it may have been a little more present in the lettuce boycott later,
right,
than it was in the
right
grape boycott.
Yeah.
And during your talking, you've mentioned a lot about Cesar Chavez. I assume you remember his visit, because there's many photos of him standing on the steps of your church in Northside in St. Joseph's. And do you remember that during the time of Chavez's visit, in terms of some of the political folks who were activists, that there had started to be some questions of groups challenging members of, particularly people who had either been identified or had been named themselves as members of the Communist Party, that there started to be a little bit of tension about whether other folks in the movement, particularly the unions, felt comfortable marching with them, and that during the Caesar's visit, that was a little bit of a problem when I think it was one woman, was asked to leave the line during the demonstrations. Do you remember that at all?
I remember that, but I don't remember the particulars. But I also knew that we were always reminded that there could be provocateurs in the crowd.
Right.
And we were always suspicious of someone that either made too much noise or wanted to do something that might be less than peaceful. And we were very suspicious of that.
Right.
And the communist thing was always, not always, but sometimes created some tension. But at the end of the day, it was the rank and file people that ruled the day. I mean, it was tension that some leadership people dealt with, and I'm not sure how it was dealt with, but I never thought it became too big of a problem.
Okay.
Because it was kind of dealt with, and I think it at the end of the day, it wasn't a real big problem in Pittsburgh, to my knowledge, no.
Okay.
I'm not sure I was in on, you know, all
it
of
was
it.
Some, I think probably the people who were upset may have been in some of the other groups who were supporting the boycott more probably than some of the, I would say, you know, some of the religious groups and other political activists. But it's just some, just mentioning the conflicts, that's one thing that had come up. And in terms of the symbols, I just have some questions about the use of symbols in the farm worker struggle, and obviously being a pastor and a member of a church that uses symbols, this is probably very appropriate. And I'm wondering if you remember the flags and the banners of the Our Lady of Guadalupe and the Huelga flag, specifically, that would be in pretty much all the demonstrations. And do you remember this happening when there were marches? There were lots of symbols that were coming along with all the folks that were marching. And I would say they're probably cultural symbols. And were you personally comfortable with the use of those images that we could say the Mexican-American community felt very close to? And obviously Caesar used these images too. Were you comfortable using having those with you as you marched along?
Oh, there's no question about it that, you know, that was also, you know, during a period of time when the church understood that if you wanted to be a person that would work in a community, unlike the community that you grew up in, you had better be very sensitive to people's practice and culture. And so we learned early on Our Lady of Guadalupe was an important part of Mexican Americans' religion. So you learn to respect other people's signs and symbols. I can remember at liturgy very often, you know, Our Lady of Guadalupe was, there would be a banner of her in the procession and so forth. It was wonderful, a symbol and sign that made the farm workers feel much more comfortable and at home. And I often, people made vestments at different times, and many of the vestments were culturally Mexican-American. Mm-hmm. And I was privileged to wear the vestments. I'm thinking, oh, I have a vestment in the other room or somewhere here that the Black Eagle on it. Mm-hmm. And different people made these vestments, and we would have this liturgy with the wonderful music and singing right. De Coloris and so forth really helped us, help us appreciate some of also culture, and taught us a lot about liturgy in another culture and another language. So it was always inspiring.
Well, as members of, in terms of the Catholic community, probably since most of the farm workers were members of the same tradition, we, even though there were different cultures, we did, there were really similarities in terms of the imagery. And there were many groups who were involved in the boycott who, of course, did not have these symbols, or perhaps it was very foreign. Did it ever? Did anyone ever mention to you, or did, in looking back, do you think it may have been a very new concept to people to have these cultural and religious images coming along with the political message, which probably didn't happen a lot before, at least in Pittsburgh? Mm-hmm. And obviously you were comfortable with them, but do you think that in looking back, this might have been quite different, let's say for the unions to start seeing all these images coming along with something that was really a labor struggle for them, but and looking back, you think that may have been quite new and something?
Well, I think Pittsburgh is a unique community because a high density of Catholics are union members. Mm-hmm. The other thing is, I think that the anyone in that line would respect the leadership, and clearly the leaders of the movement were people like the Rojas family. I mean, Albert and Elena are articulate people. Very bright people, very committed people. So if you join that line, that procession, why, I never thought much about that, but I never heard anyone criticize, you know, the culture or the religion symbols. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe it took place, but I certainly didn't hear about it, and it never became an issue. I mean, it was very right. obvious to the people who were informed that the farm workers were people of faith, and mostly Christian and mostly Catholic.
Right.
So if you join the line, that shouldn't be an issue with you. I mean, if I join a picket line of people from the Mideast, and I support their cause. Obviously, they're going to bring their culture and their faith into it, and I ought not to be offended.
Right. Okay, thank you. And I have just some questions about sort of reflecting on the whole experience. Looking back over the experience, would you say that this was a good experience for you and that you actually felt that the farm workers were helped by, you know, your personal participation?
Well, there's no doubt about it that previous questions and my answers, I always received more than I gave. Mm-hmm. And I gave because I was challenged in my faith to do the right thing. I received much more out of it. If they received any help from me, or if I in many ways, or different ways, represented the institutional church, I'm happy for the situation. Mm-hmm. And, by the same token, I probably alienated some Catholics who would be employees, and I know I did, at the produce yards. So that goes with the territory. You know, I remember Cesar Chavez saying, you know, there's a picket, there's a line there, and, you know, they used to sing that song, "Which Side Are You On?" It was real clear that in those days and today, we're on the side of the workers, the right to organize. That's mm-hmm. a good Catholic social teaching.
Okay.
So what they did was help me implement the teaching that I had. I came out of the seminary with a lot of energy, and I got real lucky to be in a neighborhood that was transitional and becoming more black. And the Rojas family, who were brown, taught me, you know, how to get along with people and respect other people's culture. So I certainly owe more to them than I ever received. And sure, I think Caesar and the Rojas's, I would never use the word use the church. I think they encouraged and challenged their church people to do what they say they preached. And there was no one, I don't think, could say no to that opportunity. It was just the right thing, and it was the faith thing to do.
Well, thank you. And one other thing, is, since you were in the North Side, which was an African-American section, and I assume still is, in Pittsburgh, at the time of the boycott, there was the feeling coming about at the time of black power and the time of black separatism that a lot of times white people were feeling somewhat uncomfortable in the black neighborhoods. And I'm wondering if when this occurred, and I know it occurred in Pittsburgh, was there any feeling on your part that white people may not have been as welcome in the black community struggles at that time as might have been in the boycott, and that it was somewhat easier for white people or Anglos to maybe participate in the boycott than some of the black movement at that time in that particular neighborhood, in that particular, you know, city where you were, or was that not really a concern?
Well, obviously, after Dr. King's assassination, a lot of people were not welcome in the black community. Mm-hmm. But that was a feeling of rage that a lot of people felt their leader was killed. And there was a black power consciousness going on, so why do people need white people to help them go through that? So yeah, there was a period of time which was very natural for alienation between black and white, and to, you know, so that was natural. And I think some people in the black community felt, well, the farm workers are getting more attention than our civil rights movement, but that was never the case. Mm-hmm. Al Rojas and Elena Rojas and the children related very well to the black community, taught us a lot about relationship, and I don't think the black community was ever threatened by brown people because they saw them as other oppressed people.
Mm-hmm.
So their relationship was very good, I always felt. But the whole black thing about the animosity towards white people is a natural reaction because we were the closest people, Caucasian, to the Caucasians that were hurting black people.
Right.
You know, so obviously when someone called you a honky, you ought not to take it personally unless you were acting like one.
Mm-hmm.
But that was really meant for maybe some leadership in Washington, D.C., or lack of leadership. And if you didn't understand that, you were reacting all day, because if you were doing the right thing, you just had to deal with that. Just like there's not a black person I ever met that hasn't been called a name. But if they're healthy and integrated, they know that's not meant for them. And if it is, it's ignorance. And if it wasn't, it's meant for some black person that maybe offended them at one time. So.
Okay, thank you. And just in closing, I'm wondering if you might have a favorite story that you remember, or something that comes to mind when you think about the boycott that you'd like to talk about. Perhaps I know that you did have, you were one of the people who was probably singled out for arrest, perhaps more than other people. And I'm just wondering if there's anything that, when we talk about the boycott, sort of pops to your mind as, you know, sort of a story you might be telling others, or, you know, people who would be asking about this time, like right now.
Well, my dad was, and we grew up in the produce yards area, in the strip district, they call it. And my dad was a ward chairman. And so the people on the docks who worked in the produce yards knew my father, because my father would go down there regularly when we were kids, I guess, to get food for us and food for some of the poor people in that community. Mm-hmm. So I think sometimes I was singled out because I was a priest, and a lot of Catholics think priests should stay in their pulpit. And I also got singled out because they knew my roots and they knew my dad. And so very often they might, you know, say some things to personally attack my heritage or my family or myself. But they were angry because they saw the farm workers union as a real economic threat to them. And they wanted to know why a Caucasian priest or something would do that. So there were times when I would, or same the police officers too, you know, what's this white priest hanging out with, you know, radical students and peaceniks and people of color, you know. But they didn't have the advantage I had. They didn't have the insight. I mean, not the insight, but they didn't have the experience I had. Because once you have that experience, you cannot not be a part of that. Mm-hmm. So I was lucky enough to get in a position to meet farm workers. And so, I mean, that's not a particular story, but traveling with Al Rojas too, you know, I heard a lot of abuses leveled at him, and but at the same time, I saw he dealt with it very well, and he was a very bright and courageous person that stood up to opposition. He kind of had no fear, and it was a little scary to go with him at some places because he didn't have any fear.
Yeah.
The thing that I remember the most when I hear the boycott farm worker is, I think of all the mornings that we got up to go down the produce yards to pick it, and I thought, oh boy, what dedication they have, you know.
Yeah.
And I remember going to bed at midnight thinking, I have to get up in 2 hours.
Yeah.
But, you know, when you look back at it, you think, well, that was the right thing to do, and was I lucky to be a part of that.
Oh, hey, thank you. Well, listen, I thank you very much for participating in this oral history. And once again, this is Father Jack O'Malley, and it is Saturday evening and April 6th. And thanks very much for sharing all your views with us.
You're welcome.
Okay.
Thank you.